The title of this seminar is A Less Hurried Approach to Homeschooling Young Children. And, yeah, the handout is in the syllabus, or at least it's supposed to be. Let's begin with a word of prayer. I think we need some prayer. Our Father in heaven, Thou art holy and righteous and true, and unto Thee is all due all honor and glory and blessing. We ask Thee this afternoon that Thou wouldst grant unto all of us hearing ears and minds which discern the truth and practical knowledge and hearts which will apply these things with wisdom. We ask for physical strength for particularly my wife who's feeling weak, and we ask for all of us that you would bless us with your word wherever it may be mentioned and give us a sound understanding of your word. Amen. When we say we are talking about a less hurried approach to homeschooling, we obviously are saying that there are other approaches which are more hurried. Just what is it that we think others are in a hurry about? And why do we think that we should be in less of a hurry? Before we go too far, let's put one possible misconception aside. When we say less hurried, we are not talking about unschooling. We strongly disagree with the unstructured and unguided approach of unschooling. The primary tenet of the advocates of unschooling is that the child should be left to determine his own direction. The whole tenor of the scriptures disagrees with such a notion. Proverbs 29:15 reads, "The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame." Let's look at the first half of this verse for a minute before we focus on the second half. The scripture tells us that a child must be disciplined and reproved for his misbehavior. Another scripture says in Proverbs 22:6, one you're very familiar with, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." We are to intellectually train up our children. They are not to be left to determine their own direction, but they are to be turned from the wrong direction and trained in the right direction. Proverbs 10:1 and 17:21 and 25, we read, "A wise son maketh a glad father, but a foolish son is the heaviness of his mother. He that begetteth a fool doeth it to his sorrow, and the father of a fool hath no joy. A foolish son is a grief to his father, and bitterness to her that bare him." We are not to raise fools. And fools are those who are left to themselves, not trained in the ways of the Lord. Wisdom and foolishness are not limited to outward behavior and misbehavior. They include inward and intellectual behavior. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. Now our focus is on the second half of this Proverbs 29:15. "A child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame." Children are not to be left unschooled. They are to be trained and to be taught. And we have often said that a young child needs more training than he needs teaching. To train is to cause to grow in the desired direction. We might train ivy to grow up a wall, and we ought to train children to grow toward God. To teach is to cause to know. We ought to teach children to know about God. Notice we did not say a child needs only training and no teaching. Training and teaching go hand in hand. But with younger children, the training predominates, and this need for training gradually gives way to more teaching as the child matures. If we have done our training at an early age, then an older child will be prepared for plenty of teaching and will need very little training. Besides, training older children is much harder because it involves more breaking of old habits than making of new ones. But in neither the training nor the teaching do we advocate leaving the child entirely to his own interests. Children are not little adults. A child must be trained in self-control and self-discipline, and he must be trained in the tools and equipment which he needs to prepare him for more rigorous academic studies when he's older. The proper goal for teaching is to give students the tools with which to learn on their own, to liberate them from the drudgery of task performance, and to make them independent scholars. So we quite agree with the need for early discipline and early training of children. However, we are concerned about how this may be accomplished. Some believe it's never too early to pursue academics on a rigorous and demanding scale. We believe that though we may get apparent results this way, many of these results are actually outcome-based, and they bypass certain developmental basics for which a price will often be paid later. Yes, we want our children to learn the value of hard work, but there is a difference between hard work and exasperation. We believe it is an error to suppose that young children are developmentally equipped to handle information in the same manner as adults. A very different process is going on during the younger years. To use a computer analogy, adults should have all of their operating system and basic software in working order. But children are still receiving their elementary programming. Formatting errors will abound if we simply input raw data, mere academics, before the programming is completed. Much more is involved than mere academics. In Ephesians 6:4, we read, "And, O ye fathers, do not aggravate or exasperate your children. Rather, nurture them in the full maturity, into full maturity in the correction and counsel of the Lord." And in Colossians 3:21, we read, "O ye fathers, do not overstimulate or provoke too far your children in order that they should not be broken in spirit or disheartened." The Greek word here for aggravate or exasperate and the word for overstimulate or provoke too far, these words convey the idea of pushing the child too far beyond his capacity to the point of justifiable anger and broken desperation. An exaggerated example of this is in English literature, the young Paul Dombey of Dombey's son, Charles Dickens' character, who was literally taught to death before the age of 10. Interesting story. To overstimulate and to aggravate, to provoke and to exasperate, this is what happens when we place a greater burden upon someone than he is developmentally able to bear. We have the example of our Heavenly Father to follow. In 1 Corinthians 10:13, we read, "God is faithful, who will not leave you alone so as to be tested beyond what level ye are capable of bearing. Rather, along with the testing, he will also make an overload escape in order for you to be able to bear up under the load." The Greek word here for escape means a place to step out and out of bounds, an end or a limit. Our Heavenly Father is a faithful Father. As He develops and trains our spiritual growth, He continually tests and challenges us, but He is careful not to require more than we are capable of bearing. We as fathers are to nurture our children to full maturity, not drive them there. Each and every child is one of a kind growing up in the unique family which God has placed him in. The nurturing process is different for each and every child, and it requires plenty of micromanagement. We disagree with the one-formula-fits-all approach, which seeks to press every child into the same mold. Education does not occur in a factory assembly line. We cannot just run our children down an academic conveyor belt and expect them to emerge at the end as well-manufactured machines. The factory is a model of efficient manipulation of many inanimate objects in order to manufacture multiple look-alike products. The fragile nature of our child's character is such that it demands that they be custom-built, not mass-produced, look-alike factory models. We, the parents, must determine for ourselves, under the direction and guidance of the Lord, what is the best approach for our own family and for each of our own children. Now, before age 10, have we got overhead here or not? I don't remember. Before age 10, the child is mostly dependent upon his concrete sensory experiences for learning. To put it in computer lingo, he's still booting up. Around age 10, the child enters a more intense phase where his brain becomes physically able to make more complex connections, which, among other things, makes the child more able to handle abstract concepts, and which helps the child with self-management and self-control. Force-feeding academic studies before age 10 is not an efficient use of time. It is not necessarily going to accomplish all of the good which you desire, and it has the potential for working some harm. Of course, the exact age differs from child to child, but about age 10, the child becomes developmentally mature enough to pursue studies which are more academic. Before age 10, the focus should be on building a good foundation for those later academics. We suggest that formal academics should be the focus after age 10. If we exercise those parts of our child's mind which are developing, we will strengthen and enlarge his capacities. In her book, Endangered Minds, Jane Healy wrote, "I would contend that much of today's school failure results from academic expectations for which children's brains were not prepared, but which were bulldozed into them anyway. The brain grows best when it is challenged, so high standards for children's learning are important. Nevertheless, curriculum needs to be considered in terms of brain-appropriate challenge. Reorganizing synapses, that's the connections in your brain, is much more difficult than having the patience to help them get arranged properly the first time around." In the early years, we want to sow such seeds as honoring God and parents, developing the capacity for language, developing the appetite for learning, enriching the memory, encouraging creativity, and instilling a good work and service ethic. These are the kind of things which will lay a good foundation for the formal academics later. The first thing should come first. Academics must be built upon a very good moral foundation. If we lay a good foundation of self-discipline and moral character in the early years, the academic instruction of later years will be much more productive. Instead of focusing solely upon academic concerns in the early years, we should also be training our children in proper behavior and developing his moral outlook by teaching him household management chores, involving him in doing service for others, and pursuing special projects with him which are designed to instill traits of diligence, perseverance, attention to detail, and the like. The more we read to children, the larger their minds will be. They'll have a larger vocabulary, which, by the way, is the number one index of intelligence, a larger store of categories of thought, and a greater love of learning. At age 10, with a well-prepared mind, you can choose the curriculum which best suits both your child and your circumstances. But if you lay a firm foundation, then you can build upon it a mighty edifice. But if you begin hastily on the building while skimping on the foundation, then the building may sag and lean and parts may fall as the foundation sinks or crumbles beneath it.
Yes. We're going to go over 10 things to do with children before age 10. I'm going to sit down. You don't mind if I sit down, do you? Okay. In the years before age 10, we're going to be building the foundation of the house, in a sense. We're going to be building the foundation of your child's mind. So those years before 10 are very, very important. And what we want to do is talk about the 10 things that will help you build the foundation of your child's mind. Now, the first thing you're going to want to do, one of the things is reading and writing. Sometime before your child reaches the age of 10, you should teach him to read using a good intensive phonics method. The first question might be, at what age should I begin? A few children will learn to read at age 4, just a few. A few may be fully 10 years old before they can confidently read a basic reader. However, most children will learn to read sometime between the ages of 5 and 8. Now, the age that a child learns to read has no bearing on their intelligence or does not determine how well they'll be doing academically later on. Our own children learn to read anywhere between the ages of 5 and 9. We suggest that you begin intensive phonics at age 5 or 6, and then if after a reasonable amount of time you find that your child is not retaining any of the instruction, then put it aside and wait a few months before attempting it again, and then continue this routine until it sticks. Homeschooling families have lots of good intensive phonics curricula from which to choose. What are some of the intensive phonics curricula you use? Christ-centered learning, yes, it's a good intensive phonics curriculum. Sing, Spell, Read, and Write is good intensive phonics. Alpha Phonics by Blumenfeld, that's a very good phonics program. Tatras is another one, T-A-T-R-A-S, that's Teach America to Read and Spell. That's a good inexpensive, Tatras is Writing Road to Reading Made Easy. That's the one I'd use if I was to teach my kids over again. When your child becomes reasonably proficient at printing his letters and he's on the road to learning how to read, then you can begin him on copy work. The practice of copy work dates back to ancient times and is, along with oral narration, which I'm going to talk about later, the first step in teaching a child how to write. Copy work is a good way to practice handwriting skills, reinforce phonics instruction, introduce grammar and proper sentence structure, and will lay a foundation for creative writing. What copy work is you lay before the child's eyes something you want him to reproduce with his pen and pencil, say a Bible verse. Put it before his eyes, and he will write it word for word. Your child should spend some time each day doing copy work. Ruth Beechick, in her book, A Strong Start to Language, and Cindy Rushton, Language Arts the Easy Way, outline how to incorporate copy work into your curriculum. Your child may copy from the Bible one day, copy poetry or literature another day, copy famous speeches or sayings of important men on another day. So they should be spending some time doing copy work each day. Number two is oral narration. In Britain, at the close of the 19th century, Charlotte Mason developed the concept of narration as a method of teaching. In her book, For the Children's Sake, Susan Schaefer-McCulley has reintroduced narration to homeschooling families, and Karen Andriola followed this with A Charlotte Mason Companion. In oral narration, the parent will read to the child, or the child will read to himself. Then the child will tell back to the parent in his own words what he was just read. It's best to begin narration at an early age, say when the child is 4 or 5. Practice it on a daily basis all the way through high school. Narration is actually very difficult to do. Could you, without notes, narrate to me the sermon you heard last Sunday? Most of us couldn't do it because we've not trained our mind to be able to listen and then to tell back. Do you see how narration will build and strengthen the mind? This is one of the stones in the foundation that you're building of your child's mind. It will strengthen and train the child's mind.
I'm not sure I could do it with notes.
Okay, and along with oral narration is memorization. Number three, yes. Memorization should be begun when your child is young, even as young as 2 or 3, and continue throughout life. Time should be spent every day reciting memory work. Encourage your child to memorize such things as the Greek and Hebrew alphabets, passages from the Bible, poetry, catechisms, excerpts from literature. And then your child could memorize passages of the Bible in Greek or Latin, and from the same passage in English, in order to give them a feel for the language. Memorizing passages of literature will prepare your child for the study of formal grammar at age 10. This will give him a feel for the way sentences and paragraphs are put together, and it will help him with his vocabulary. Memorizing also prepares your child to be a good writer. What goes into your into the child's head as a little one will come out later as he writes. So together, memorization and oral narration will train, sharpen, and strengthen the mind, and which prepares your child for more rigorous studies later on. And that's precisely what we want to do in these early years before age 10. You want to train your child's mind. Now, by contrast, what are some things you could do in your home that would work in the opposite direction, would not train your child's mind, would not build up the mind? Television, computer games, a lot of computer software, video games, those sorts of things will work in the opposite direction. And we would suggest to you that you would avoid those sorts of things, especially in the years before age 10. Okay. Number four is hearing and listening. By reading aloud to your child, he learns the sounds of words, he increases his vocabulary, he enlarges his conceptions of the world, and he develops his imagination. And we suggest that you read to your child at least 2 hours each day. Read from a wide variety of literature, good literature, biographies, historical fiction, science, geography, art, history. Some parents will combine narration with a read-aloud times. And don't be afraid to read long chapter books to young children. A five-year-old is perfectly capable of understanding Jules Verne or Robert Louis Stevenson. And don't waste your time reading fast food type books. What do I mean by fast food type books? Goosebumps. What are some other examples of fast food type books? Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew, or what about those books that are Harry Potter books? Those are fast food type books. Why should you avoid those sorts of things? Let's say you had a daughter and from birth you gave her hamburgers, french fries, and chocolate shake. And then at age 10 you had her eat asparagus. What would she do? She wouldn't like it because she's developed the wrong type of appetite. It's the same with literature. You want to develop the proper type of appetite in your child while they're young so that when they're older, they will be able to understand and appreciate the good literature. And don't require your child to sit right beside you on the couch perfectly still while you read aloud to them, but let them play on the floor with their toys, do their cross stitch, do their sewing. In our family, the rule was you must stay in the same room and you may not talk, but you can work on whatever you want to work on while we read. I will guarantee you, by the time they are 26, they will be quiet while you read. Yes.
Some people wonder, well, won't that distract from the reading? But actually, one of my boys, for example, if he didn't have something in his hand and doing something, he couldn't listen. He had to have something.
Reading aloud is really my favorite part of homeschooling. How many others have had this experience? You're sitting on the couch. Chair won't ever do. Reading a good book, okay. Somebody's over here, right beside you. Somebody's over here. Somebody's on the lap. Somebody's in the back, behind your neck. Somebody's at your feet, and the rest of them just have to make do. And then everybody has to see the pictures, right? They have to be situated just so to see the pictures. How about reading in a dialect? Do you like reading in a dialect? There's lots of good books. John Buchan wrote a lot of good books that are written in dialect, Scottish dialect. I love reading in a dialect. In fact, my children refuse to go through the McDonald's drive-in when I'm in that kind of a mood. You can develop your child's idea of the continuity of history by making yourself a timeline. Get a long piece of computer paper, put a line down the middle, 4004 BC on one end, today's date on the other end, stick it to your living room wall, and that's going to leave it there for the next 20 years, and that's your family's lifelong timeline. Yes. Greek and Hebrew alphabets. We'll get to that in a little bit. Okay. Whenever you read something of an historical nature, mark it on the timeline so they get an idea of the continuity of history. Number 5 is family worship. Contrary to the old saying, the family which prays together stays together, studies have shown that the family which only prays together, that is, worships together only at church, does not usually stay together. The family which stays together is the family which prays and studies the Bible together regularly as a family at home. And we have a pamphlet on family worship at our table if you're interested in that. Number 6 is arts and crafts. You want to develop the child's, help them develop their creativity using arts and crafts. This is another stone in the foundation. And you want to give them the tools, the time, and the space so they can have plenty of time to work on their arts and crafts. Wherever you do your reading aloud, put a low shelf filled with all kinds of good quality art supplies and craft supplies. You have a table and chairs. So they can bring out their art supplies, crafts, and work on them while you're reading aloud or any time during the day. And don't make them always put everything away. Nothing more discouraging to a young artist to have to put everything away at the end of the day. Number 7 is field trips in the library. Take field trips frequently. Take time to attend concerts and plays, museums and exhibits. Visit workplaces. When your child is 4 or 5, begin attending the local science and engineering fair. You probably have something like that. Anybody here been to the science and engineering fair? It's a public and private school and homeschool event. They're usually held sometime in March. I would go attend it now when your children are little. And then when they're about 13, have your children enter a science fair project. Early on, form the habit of visiting the library on a weekly basis. At a young age, a child will become familiar with where to find the different assortments of books. Of course, when they're young, they're just going to go to the public library. Teach them where the biographies are, the fiction is, where the nonfiction is, how to talk to the librarian, how to use the computer. And then when they're about 13, take them to a good college library so they become familiar with using the Library of Congress system. And then when they're about 14 or 15, take them to a big university library. What's the biggest university library you have here? Something in Chicago? Okay. How many of you have been to a big university library and taken your children there? By the time they're 18, they should be able to be thoroughly familiar with doing research in a big university library. And you don't have to worry about it if you don't know how to do it, because you're going to start out when they're young with your public library, then your college library, then the university library. Start out young, and you'll learn it right along with your children. Number 8 is work and service. You want to develop in your child a love for work and service. From the time a child is able to walk and talk, he should be given regular chores to perform. And I don't mean just feeding the dog and making the bed. I'm talking about a 5-year-old is perfectly capable of putting all your laundry away, folding it and putting it away, putting your dishes away, setting the table. A 10-year-old is perfectly capable of preparing an entire meal, a simple meal, from start to finish. You as a mother should not be going around picking up things off the floor and putting it away. Your children should be doing all of that for you. I don't cook. I haven't cooked in years. My daughters do all that for me, and that should be a goal. By the time they're in their teens, they should be able to take over the running of the household. Now, along with work, children should be taught to serve, and there's lots of opportunities for community service in an area this size. We visited nursing homes for numerous years. Our girls crocheted with thread tiny baby booties for different pro-life organizations. When a mother had a positive pregnancy test, they gave her a pair of baby booties as her first baby gift. Another area of need is the neonatal intensive care units in your hospitals. They need hospital gowns for the tiny babies that are born there. Number 9 is discipline. Some people have questioned why we talk about discipline in a seminar on academics, but actually we found in our own experience that if the area of discipline is neglected, then we may as well forget about the academics. Children will never learn self-discipline if parents do not train them in it. The child who does not develop self-discipline will fail in many things, including the academics for which you are preparing him for. You want to ask yourself these 3 questions. Am I satisfied with the obedience of my children? Do I enjoy being around my children? And do my children honor and respect me? If your answer is no to any of these questions, then you should perhaps reevaluate your priorities. Because if you do, okay, those 3 questions are, am I satisfied with the obedience of my children? Do I enjoy being around my children? And do my children honor and respect me? A book that we would recommend is called The Mother at Home, by John Abbott. It was originally published in 1833, and it's an excellent book in how you can and why you should get to first-time obedience from your children. Now, number 10, the last thing is you want to give your child plenty of time to play and explore. Okay, you want to talk?
My turn. Do not let your child play in a cyber world. He can play in a miniature world. He can play in a pretend world. But it must be made of objects which exist in the real three-dimensional world, not electrons hitting an opaque two-dimensional phosphorescent screen. Why? Because though he may learn something from the screen image, many things which he is not learning, precisely because it is only a screen image. Besides missing the sensory experiences of touching, tasting, smelling, hearing, seeing, three-dimensionally, there are logical things missing as well, such as consequences for actions in the real world. When the computer substitutes for the functions and processes which the brain normally supplies, the brain is left to atrophy. It does not develop its brain muscles, as it were. No pain, no gain. If you don't use it, you're going to lose it. Excessive use of computers, especially at early ages, will restructure the way the brain processes information, often for the worse. It also causes the underdevelopment of the emotional and social dimensions of the child. Young children are developing many parts of their understanding, and holes can occur in their development if they are deprived of certain experiences during critical periods of time. These may not be discovered until much later. Televisions and computers can be very useful tools under the proper circumstances and controls, but they are like fire, a useful servant, but a fearful master. There are many legitimate reasons to doubt their value for children below the age of 10.
Okay, now we're going to talk about the age group from ages 10 through 12 right now. In this age group, academic discipline becomes more structured and formal, and the study of formal language grammar and the study of mathematics has begun. Consider this basic maxim of homeschooling. How many of you agree with this? There's only so much time in the day. Keep this in mind as you consider which of the many subjects your child will study throughout his school-age years. What is the wisest use of your time? Age 10 is approximately the age when children are ready for more formal academics. Around age 10, the light bulb goes on, and the brain becomes physically able to make more complex connections, which, among other things, makes your child more able to handle abstract concepts. And will help your child with self-management and self-control. Now we're going to talk about 10 things to do which we believe are important for children in this age group. Again, number one is family worship. We believe this is not just something to add on if you happen to have time. This is very central. Number two is reading literature and reading aloud. Daily require your child to read something in the area of classical fiction, poetry, or short stories. Now, of course, many children are already reading quite a bit at this age on their own. Old readers such as McGuffey's are very good sources for this type of literature. It's not necessary to buy graded reading textbooks. You can just use the library instead. Though your children are now reading on their own, you want to continue to read aloud to your children 2 hours per day. This probably will be your favorite. How many of you love to read aloud to your kids? Would you like to have more time? Right. What are some of your favorite read aloud books? Pardon me? Little House on the Prairie. I love those books. Those are wonderful. Pollyanna. Chronicles of Narnia. I can't stand those books. My kids love them. Harvey likes them. I don't understand it. I just don't get it. I don't know why. But how about The Door in the Wall by Marguerite D'Angeli? Robinson Crusoe. Read that in the unabridged version. It's very good. Or G.A. Henty books. We have a book list called Hand That Rocks the Cradle that lists all the books that we have read over the last 20 years. You want to continue requiring oral narration also. History is a large subject with many variables, and I'm not going to talk a lot about history here. By age 10, your child should be reading from history and narrating it back to you. Biographies, autobiographies, and historical fiction are ideally suited for this purpose. Again, use the library. You can study history either chronologically, or you may study history according to interest, or you may do both depending on what your goals in history are. Reading and studying history is actually my favorite part of homeschooling. For many years, our family organized a citywide history fair for homeschoolers. Each of our children from about ages 10 on up was required to produce a history project, and making a history project will require skills in communication and in researching and all kinds of things. Number four is composition. By age 10, your child should be writing something every day. From ages 10 through 12, you should keep it simple. Copy work, which we talked about before, dictation, letters to relatives or pen pals, journal entries, and simple outlining skills. All this would be in addition to the writing, which they'll do in math and spelling and English grammar. Number 5 is spelling and English grammar.
There's a difference between learning a language and learning grammar. Children begin to learn their native language from their earliest age, and they can develop skill in speaking several languages while they're still in their youngest years. Indeed, this is the optimal time for developing spoken proficiency in language. Formal grammar, however, is the study of the structure of a language, and such study should be delayed until the brain is developed to handle it. Some begin the formal study of English grammar at age 6, first grade. We would recommend beginning at age 10, grade level 5. By age 10, your child can comprehend the abstract grammatical concepts of noun, verb, participle, gerund. English grammar or any language grammar can be readily learned. Before age 10, memorization, oral narration, reading aloud, and copy work will build a solid foundation for the study of formal grammar later. Because of the way that the brain is structured before age 10, we believe that memorizing passages of literature would be much more profitable than memorizing deductive paradigms of a language in a formal grammar. One part of the brain handles the language, and another part of the brain handles the grammatical analysis of the language. The part which handles the language is well developed by age 4 or so. The child learns inductively that the subject comes before the verb and that the direct object comes after the verb, even though he has no way of conceiving what a subject, a verb, or a direct object are. He learns vocabulary and style without any way of conceiving what a noun, a verb, a preposition, or iambic pentameter is. He enjoys language. The part of the brain which handles the formal grammar is developed by age 10 or so. If you force the formal grammar too early, then you will put the information in odd places of the brain, and it is more difficult for the brain to assimilate and make use of that information. 3 years, ages 10 through 12, for studying English grammar and spelling are usually sufficient. If your child studies Latin or Greek or any other foreign language, the grammar of them by age 13, this may render the further study of English grammar quite unnecessary. Studies which assess the value of learning foreign languages at an early age show that persons who learned a foreign language before the age of 10 used the same part of the brain to think in that language that he used to think in English. Persons who learned a second language after the age of 10 used a totally separate part of the brain to process that language. It seems far better and easier to learn a foreign language before the age of 10. Well, these tests only confirm that what we already know intuitively, that the best way to learn any foreign language is to learn it from childhood as a spoken language. This trains the ears and the tongue. The reading and the writing of the language will then come much easier because the student is already familiar with the sounds. And the grammar, which is learned later and goes in a separate part of the brain, will still come much easier because the student already has a working knowledge of that language. This applies to any language. So it would be best to learn to speak and write other languages right along with learning to speak and write English. Unfortunately, most families are not multilingual, so this isn't an easy task. We do have a tape at our table called Learning Classical Languages, which includes a number of suggestions for sort of filling in that gap for the fact that your family doesn't know how to speak Latin or Greek or Hebrew. This is from Jane Healy, Endangered Minds, Why Children Don't Think and What We Can Do About It. Abstract rule systems for grammar and usage should be taught when most students are in high school. Then, if previously prepared, they may even enjoy the challenges of this kind of abstract logical reasoning. Only, however, if the circuits are not already too cluttered up by bungled rule teaching. One ninth grade student, on the overhead, a paragraph here. One ninth grade student who came to me last year for help with grammar was hopelessly confused about the simplest parts of speech. Although she was intelligent and could, at her current age, have mastered this material in a week, she had been a victim of meaningless grammar drills since second grade. As Michelle and I struggled on the simple difference between adjectives and adverbs, I often wished I could have a neurological vacuum cleaner and just suck out of all those mixed up synapses that kept getting in our way. It took us 6 months, but finally, one day, the light dawned. "This is easy," she exclaimed. It is when brains are primed for learning and the student has a reason to use it with real literary models. Now back to the overhead. Immersing children in good language for books and tapes, modeling patterns for their own speech and writing, and letting them enjoy their proficiency in using words to manipulate ideas are valid ways to embed grammar in growing brains. No amount of worksheets or rule learning will ever make up for deficits resulting from lack of experience with the structure of real, meaningful sentences. It is folly to ignore the importance of oral storytelling, oral history, and public speaking. These skills build language competence in grammar, memory, attention, and visualization, among many other abilities. I personally believe that helping students at all grade levels memorize some pieces of good writing, narrative, expository, and poetic on a regular basis would provide good practice for language, listening, and attention. And then she adds, at the same time, schools must get into the business of teaching children to listen effectively because no one else seems to be doing it.
All right, number six is, well, we have Latin and Greek down here, but it can be any foreign language you want. Our personal preference is Greek if you're going to learn one language. If you're going to learn two, we suggest Latin and Greek, but some of you might have a better reason for learning Spanish or French. But you can introduce your child to the alphabets, any kind of alphabet, Latin, Greek, Spanish, whatever, at an early age. The Greek alphabet can be learned right along with the English alphabet. When a child is skilled in writing the Greek alphabet, then copywork exercises can include passages from the Greek New Testament. Latin grammar can begin at age 10, or any language grammar can begin at age 10. We would suggest perhaps a 10-year-old could spend 15 minutes a day studying a foreign language, while a 12-year-old could increase that to 30 minutes per day. Number seven, we have early logic. We believe that children should be taught logic, and between the ages of 10 and 12, they can start studying pre-logic. Real logic doesn't come in until age 13, and we're not going to have time to talk about that. But there's a workbook series called Building Thinking Skills that is good for teaching pre-logic skills. It's called Building Thinking Skills. All right, number eight is arithmetic.
A 10-year-old is perfectly capable of jumping right into a sixth-grade math textbook, such as Section 65, with no previous experience with math workbooks or textbooks. Skipping kindergarten through fifth grade in math will in no way hinder your child's success in math. You do not need to wear out your child's interest and your own patience attempting to make him understand what his brain is not yet wired to handle. Waiting until age 10, when your child is developmentally prepared to handle mathematical concepts readily, makes instruction in arithmetic very easy. What was painfully spread over five previous years may here be compressed painlessly into as little time as a month. We are not saying that you should keep your child away from numbers before age 10. Not at all. By age 4, most children have discovered money and the game's over at that time. Children encounter numbers all of the time. If you encourage learning, then you will be asking. If you encourage learning, then they will be asking plenty of questions, and you will have plenty of opportunities for informal instruction in numbers and measurements. But we would not encourage formal workbook instruction before age 10 unless the child shows a genuine interest and a genuine competency to handle the work. Before age 10, the child is largely acquiring the verbal skills of language, and your time is better spent developing his vocabulary, which is the primary index of intelligence. Remember the maxim, there is only so much time in the day. Your time may be much more better spent reading aloud to your children than struggling with math concepts which your child simply is not developmentally prepared to handle. What we and others recommend regarding math is basically what was practiced with outstanding success until the 20th century, that is, before formal math, before age 10, was largely introduced into the world. Cultural math failure, that's what we have today, cultural math failure coincides with the innovation of early formal workbook math. We argue that it's the method. We believe in math before age 10, but we believe the evidence is against workbook math before age 10. The developmental evidence appears very supportive of that view. The same is true with grammar, as we explained a little earlier. Not with language, but with formal grammar. It is best to learn to speak and to read and write a language before age 10, but grammar, identifying gerunds and participles, is best left until approximately age 10. Math and grammar can be learned, sometimes learned, very well before age 10. But it's not the kind of learning which we want. We may compare this to putting information in the wrong file cabinet. We have trouble later finding the information and using it. By age 10, the information is literally stored in a different part of the brain than before approximately age 10. Learning math in an abstract workbook fashion before age 10 literally causes the brain to be structured differently. If the child depends upon his early math learning drawer and does not develop a new file drawer for later math learning, then he turns into a brick wall, or he runs into a brick wall, when he encounters algebra. Now, if he learns abstract workbook math before age 10, then he will either develop a second math memory after age 10 and hopefully not have a cross-indexing problem, or else he will begin to fail in upper math. But if he learns math in a concrete, not an abstract way before age 10, and he begins to learn abstract workbook math by age 10, then the brain will develop properly, the right connections will be made, and assuming normal abilities and developments elsewhere, he will advance in math at a regular pace without unusual difficulties. And the same is true with grammar. We are satisfied that the time spent studying math, which the younger child is not yet developmentally equipped for, could better be spent developing verbal skills, which is the younger child is simply a sponge for these things in his early years. Deal with numbers in a concrete and verbal way until age 10. Use actual objects when you can, and when you can't, then use words and names for actual objects. Our culture is so full of numbers and measurements that we simply let them pass without notice. Teach the names for numerical values with dominoes. Teach counting with cards or with this game Rummy Cube. Teach addition with checkers or chess. Teach base 10 and place value with money or Quiznare rods or other manipulative math programs. Teach measuring systems with tape measures, measuring cups, weight scales, odometers. Teach fractions with pies and cakes and cooking. You need them too. Teach area by garden plotting and room arranging. One mom who had struggled with weighting in math wrote us that her son wrote down on a Sunday school form that math was his favorite subject. Since they didn't do math, she was surprised and puzzled. When she asked her son why he wrote down math, he said, "What do you mean, Mom? We talk about numbers all the time." When she sat down with her son and looked through a math program, she discovered that he already knew it all. This may be a little more intuitive and less structured than we have in mind, but it does demonstrate how well these things are taught simply as a part of life. And we've been talking about this for, 13 years now? And so far, we haven't really gotten any negative feedback. We've got stories just like this one over and over and over again. They test their children. They're worried about them testing in math. They're not going to do well because, and we always say, well, maybe they won't. But every time that somebody is tested and they've reported back to us, They did just fine. Okay, a little bit about the history and research on the teaching of math. You have some of it in your book there. Provincialism is the word which we use to describe an opinion which is narrow and self-centered in perspective. Because the common practice in our culture in our day is to begin formal instruction in arithmetic as early as age 4 or 5, many have questioned the suggestion that one may wait until age 10 before beginning formal instruction in arithmetic. Waiting until age 10 for formal instruction in arithmetic is often misnomered late start or delayed academics. Well, here's a little of the historical perspective. The ancients, here's a quote from A History of Education in Antiquity, addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, comparatively simple operations which we inflict on our children while they are still quite young, were in antiquity far beyond the horizon of any primary school. The medievals, at universities, little was done in mathematics before the middle of the 17th century. I have a note here, during the reign of Queen Elizabeth, fresh statutes were given excluding all mathematics from the course of undergraduates. Interesting. The American Calculator, first published in 1828, is reasonably typical of the colonial period. This text was used with older students beginning about the age of 11. It was complete in itself, not one book of a series such as the texts that evolved in later years. It's just stood by itself. It was an entire mathematics text. Now, when did this all change? A man named Pestalozzi is responsible for the change. It is to the latter, Pestalozzi, that we owe the greatest impetus in the rational teaching of arithmetic to young children. The essential features of his reform are as follows. First, he taught arithmetic to children as soon as they entered school, basing his work on perception. Second, he insisted upon a knowledge of numbers and the simplest operations using objects before the figures were taught. Now, skipping down to 5, he emphasized oral arithmetic and teaching no arithmetic before the child reached the age of 10 was practically universal before Pestalozzi. The formal teaching of arithmetic, just to summarize all the evidence that we have found ourselves, the formal teaching of arithmetic to young children was not practiced by the ancients, by the medievals, nor up to the modern times. In fact, it was common to withhold formal instruction in arithmetic until somewhere between the ages of 15 and 18. It was not until the 16th century that arithmetic began to be taught to children as young as age 12 or even 10. And it was Pestalozzi at the beginning of the 19th century who began to teach arithmetic to children as young as age 6 or 7, though the practice of waiting until age 10 persisted well into the 20th century. So to wait until age 10 to teach arithmetic is actually, from an historical perspective, to advocate an early start. It is only from a decidedly modern perspective that waiting until age 10 would appear to be a late start. We have not discovered any material that might contradict what we're saying here. If you ever find some, we'd like to know. Now, let's look at a little of the research from the Harvard Educational Review. Early childhood may simply be an inefficient period in which to try to teach skills that can be relatively quickly learned in adolescence. What's this quote from? What Does Research Say About Arithmetic? By Vincent J. Glennon and C.W. Hunnicutt. Over a period of a few years and in hundreds of cities, the committee, this is a particular study that they did, sought to determine the mental age level at which various topics could be taught to completion. Typically, they found that addition of like fractions required a mental age of 10 to 11 years, and unlike fractions, 14 to 15 years. Two-figure division required a mental age of 12 to 13 years. As a result, many courses of study and textbooks moved selected topics to higher grade levels, hence the name stepped-up curriculum. And from the mathematics teacher, on the basis of these and other studies, a particular study that was done by Ballard, Taylor, Wilson, and Benezet, the plan of eliminating formal arithmetic instruction from grades 1 and 2, sometimes also grade 3, has been adopted by a considerable number of school systems. In some systems, there is not even an approved plan of informal or incidental arithmetic. Such a procedure fails to recognize certain very important facts about the studies referred to above. A careful reading of the reports of these four experiments shows that while formal practice on computational processes was postponed in the experimental groups, translated what they mean is they didn't use workbook math, there was a great deal of use made in these classes of various kinds of activities, games, projects, and social situations through which the child was brought into contact with numbers and given the opportunity to use them informally in meaningful ways. In other words, they just did informal math. It is especially clear that in the studies by Wilson and Benezet that arithmetic was not, in fact, postponed at all. It is evident that what happened in these two studies was that computational arithmetic was replaced by what I call earlier in this paper social arithmetic. In each study, the plan was to emphasize number meanings, to develop an understanding of the ways in which number functions in the daily lives of children, both in and out of school, and to develop what is called number readiness for the more formal work to follow. In other words, they did concrete math before age 10. Do I need to read any more? Should I do the brain is brain? We'll do this one. This is another quote from from who? Jane Healy. You got that one up? Okay. What? Oh, it's in your handout anyway, if I don't have the overhead. I thought I had the overhead on this. It doesn't matter. We'll skip that. We're getting tired of quotes anyway. Here is what we suggest for the study of math. First, there is no necessity for formal teaching in arithmetic before age 10. Once all of the developmental parts are there, most children can learn in a few weeks everything which they might have spent 6 years learning in kindergarten through fifth grade. That is, if they haven't already learned it through questions and experiences and working things out in their own home, which is generally the case. Second, depending upon the child, upon the method, and upon the subject matter covered, there exists the potential for developmental harm from the formal teaching of arithmetic before age 10. Small children cannot understand many arithmetic concepts at an early age. We can teach them to perform the process, but we cannot make them understand the concepts. The child learns to hate learning. There was one study, I think it might be in the handout, there was one study that they studied trying to teach math earlier and then delaying it, and they also studied whether or not what the child's attitude was towards school, and all they found out was there's a direct correlation between teaching math earlier and hating school. Third, not formally teaching arithmetic before age 10 frees up a lot of time for other activities which will build the vocabulary of the child. And of course, vocabulary is the index of intelligence. Developing vocabulary was one of the deliberate foci of ancient education. We waste valuable time for developing vocabulary and verbal language skills if we instead spend those hours teaching a five-year-old only to count by fives. And he'll know intuitively how to do it by age 10 anyway. Instead, we ought to spend those hours reading to him. We only have so much time in the day. Do we want to spend it trying to force math skills into a child who developmentally is not optimally prepared, or spend it doing what he is developmentally natural, what is developmentally natural to a young child, learning new words and associating them with new ideas and experiences? Stretch the child's vocabulary during the formative years, and when he's developmentally ready to do some deeper thinking, he'll have a mind prepared to take on the task, and he'll just take off like a rocket. Oh, it's past time? Okay. Are we going to allow some questions anyway? Questions?